Welcome to Moolala, Money Made Simple on SiriusXM. Here's your host, Bruce Sellery.
Hello, I'm Bruce Sellery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. First-time homebuyers do not have it easy these days. Sure, money is cheap and easy to borrow, but getting the down payment together is not. Finance professor Moshe Milevsky is here with some tips for first-time homebuyers securing their down payment. Filing taxes is the farthest thing from fun, but we all have to do it if we're making money. Omar Sheikh is here from Echelon Wealth Partners with five things you can do now to save on taxes later. And communication is really, really important, especially with your financial advisor. Ellen Besner will be here with some tips from her book, her new book called Communication Risk. And talking about finances can be overwhelming. In fact, many Canadians don't have the basic knowledge they need in order to properly manage their finances. We'll talk about the Money Matters Financial Literacy Program from ABC with both an educator and a student. Plus, Questrade COO Steve Graham is here to talk about their new QuestWealth portfolios. All that's ahead. Let's get started. The average home price in Canada is about $495,000. In a smaller community, that'll get you a nice three-bedroom with a back deck. In a big city, that amount won't even get you a carport. The minimum down payment you'd need to purchase a home at that price, 5%, $25,000. So anyone looking to buy their first home knows how long you might have to save money before purchasing a place that you've been jazzed about. Moshe Milevsky joins us now to talk about first-time home buyers and the down payments that they require. He is a finance professor at York University's Schulich School of Business. Hello there.
Hi.
I'm going to park to the side the question of whether young people should be buying homes, but many want to, regardless. Many want to. So what should first-time home buyers know about saving the down payment?
Well, I think that, you know, the down payment is part of a much bigger equation, which is the type of debt that they're going to take on and whether they can afford that debt and whether to go fixed or floating, open or closed. So I would say that the down payment is part of a much larger conversation. But at the very least, I would say the more the merrier.
Yeah. Well, and they will be first-time homebuyers, any homebuyer, hit with CMHC insurance if they are under the 20% threshold. How do you determine if you should buy with only 5% down versus save, and wait until you've got the 20% to avoid it?
You know, as I tell many of my students at the Schulich School of Business, it's not just the spreadsheet problem. You know, this isn't just the sitting down and figuring out the numbers and should I wait another year? It's a lifestyle question as well. It's what you do for a living, where you plan to be in 5 to 10 years. I don't think it's just about the numbers.
Mm. What do you think of the home buyer's plan?
Look, you know, taking money out of some sort of shelter and utilizing funds that were earmarked for retirement or some other goal is problematic. I think that people should have a budget for where they want to live and how much they want to spend, and they should stick to that budget. And if the mortgage payment is within that budget, they should go ahead with it. But I also think that people only view the house through the prism of the mortgage, and they don't think about all the other expenses associated with home ownership, whether it's going to be insurance for the house, whether it's maintenance and it's property taxes, and then it's keeping up with the Joneses, making sure that your house looks as nice as the one on the street. So I really do think that it's not just about the down payment. You really have to think beyond that for all the other expenses you're going to incur.
Yeah, you have that great milestone of moving into your great new house and then the roof leaks and, you hate the bathroom and all that stuff.
I don't know how many people are living in empty houses because they could afford the house, but they couldn't furnish any of it.
Yeah. Now, if a young person comes to you, they don't have an RRSP already. Would you recommend they save for their down payment inside an RRSP and use the home buyer's plan or inside a TFSA?
You know, I like the TFSA, especially for people that are in low marginal tax rates, at least now where that tax benefit or the deduction isn't going to be as valuable. If you've got room to save in a TFSA, use it. I don't see any reason not to. I would certainly not save outside the TFSA for a home, to go out and purchase a home. I would use the TFSA. But I think that the bigger issue here is whether or not you're ready for home ownership, whether your personal balance sheet can sustain it, as opposed to whether you wait a year or two and save inside one shelter or another.
One of the big trends driving house prices is the bank of mom and dad. Obviously, some challenges there if they only help with the down payment and then you're in a house that doesn't have any furniture. How long do you think this one can run? How long can this trend run? Or do eventually do mom and dad get tapped out?
You know, I think that anybody's crystal ball on this one is going to be hazy. But I do think that, A, parents themselves have to think carefully about doing this because it's going to be at the expense of their own long-term stability and retirement. Second of all, and this depends on family dynamics, you are committed. I mean, if you've taken part of the down payment, even though there were no implicit or explicit strings attached when that was given, in some sense, down the line, you may have to come to their aid and you have to be ready and comfortable with that. So I would think carefully.
You also get a vote on the carpet and the paint color, I think. Or maybe not.
Well, they get to criticize.
Yeah, you get to criticize, sure. Hey, young people have never seen a downturn in housing. In fact, you know, many people who are middle age really don't remember what it was like in Toronto in the late 80s, for sure. What would you want young people to know about history?
Well, I think that part of finance is teaching history. In fact, you know, there's an entire generation that doesn't know what a market downturn is because in the last 10 years, we haven't really had a downturn. Whether it's real estate or financial markets. We talk about the financial crisis of 08 and 09 as if it was yesterday, but if you're 25, this never occurred because you don't remember what happened when you were 13 or 14. So I think financial history is a big part of financial planning, and you want to go through and do case studies. You obviously want to make it interesting, but financial history teaches us that when things go bad, a lot of things on our balance sheets go bad at the same time. Bad news comes in pairs and triplets and quadruplets.
For example?
Look, you know, here's one example, and, you know, we'll talk about other cases that are more relevant to Canada. But think about what's happening in California with the fires and people that have been devastated in terms of their home, people that have had their jobs impacted. But now let's talk about Pacific Gas and Electric, PG&E, the utility company there, whose stock price plummets. Employees suffer. They have a stock purchase plan. They suffer as well. You get hit with your financial capital and your human capital at the same time. Or let's go to Alberta, where oil prices decline and then real estate prices decline and employment prospects dim. It's never just one thing that goes wrong. And I think with housing, you have to take that into account as well.
One of the things young people are doing, if they actually can get into the market, is getting creative in how to meet that monthly mortgage payment. I know one young person who's renting out two of her three bedrooms on Airbnb. What's your wisdom on these kind of alternative paths?
Look, as long as you go into it with your eyes open and you're aware of the risk of being a homeowner and you're aware of the tax implications and the legal implications of having somebody living there that you're not quite happy with, and good luck trying to get them out or to get rid of them if it doesn't work out. I think that these are all great ways to make sure that you can afford your payments. But going into this, you have to understand these are all time-consuming activities. And whether or not your time is better spent doing something else. I mean, it's not free in terms of time. If you have a decent job and you earn a good wage per hour, it might be better to do overtime to make those payments. But I certainly see that happening. And all these empty condos and houses are eventually going to be Airbnb.
We talked about some of the other expenses that go alongside owning a home. So that's a part of the spreadsheet, certainly. When should young people consider approaching a financial institution in their purchase process? Is it before they go to their first open house? Is it 5 minutes before they want to drop an offer on a home?
Look, I'm not sure the process of approaching a financial institution today is what it was 10 or 15 years ago. You know, you can search online and get pre-approval. Is that approaching a financial institution when you're sitting in your pajamas and doing it on your laptop? I do think you should get some sense of how much is the most you can absolutely borrow. And the earlier you know that, the better, because your eyes tend to get much larger than your wallet.
You work with a lot of people given your job, a lot of young people given your job. What is the one question you keep getting asked that you wished you could answer once and never have to answer live again? What do they all want to know, or what are they all frustrated by or confused about that you can now answer for all eternity in this interview?
Well, I think they want to know whether housing prices are going to continue to increase the way they have in the last 10 or 20 years. And I have to say there's no guarantee of that. And I find myself repeating that over and over again.
Are you optimistic or pessimistic about that question?
You know, generally speaking, I'm realistic. I think it's obviously going to be regional. It depends where you are. Is it a condo? Is it a house? Is it downtown? Is it in the suburbs? Is it in economically vibrant neighborhoods? Is it in places where people want to actually live? I just am afraid of the amount of money that's being placed into one asset. Mm. People are spending almost their entire human capital on a house. Add up all the income and wages you're going to earn over the course of your life on an after-tax basis. Maybe $1 million, $1.5 million. Realistically, the sum of everything you will earn ever, all of it is going into house. I'm uncomfortable with that.
I hear you, and I agree. Moshe, thank you for your time.
My pleasure.
Moshe Bilevsky is a finance professor at York University's Schulich School of Business.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Robo-advisors like Wealthsimple and Wealthbar have received a lot of press in the last couple of years. But before the launch of these upstarts, there was Questrade, a discount brokerage that's been offering these kinds of portfolios since about 2014. The company has recently introduced Quest Wealth Portfolios, what it calls an improved version of the Questrade Portfolio IQ. Stephen Graham is Questrade's chief operating officer, and he's here to tell us more about that. Hi there.
Hey, Bruce. How are you?
Why this move, aside from the fact that the market's really competitive and you always got to be doing something?
Yeah, I think when we introduced Portfolio IQ, which was among the first portfolios of ETFs, which is a great alternative to, you know, typical mutual fund investing because it gives you diversified investing across a range of portfolios from conservative up through to aggressive growth. When we introduced that back in 2014, we were among the first, and in fact, we were the first where somebody could do the entire risk tolerance questionnaire online, so they could sign up for a portfolio and do this all online. And at the time, it was you know, quite a breakthrough thing, and the market continues to move. And so we've learned from what we've done and what's competitively happening in the marketplace. And we want to be the innovator. We want to be a low-fee leader by taking, you know, cost out for customers so they can earn better returns by reducing fees and keep more of the earnings they get from the market. And so we felt it was time to kind of
refresh. Is this basis point change from about 25 before and about 7 now? Is that right?
Yeah. So what before management fee started at 0.7 percent on smaller balances and went down to 0.35% over $1 million. And now what we've done is gone a simplified schedule, which is if it's under 100,000, it's 0.25%, so significantly less. And if you invest over 100,000, it's 0.2%. So, and that makes it probably the most competitive in the marketplace in terms of low fees for investing in a portfolio of ETFs. And the other thing with respect to Quest Wealth portfolios, which we've renamed them just so people have a better understanding of what they are. The other thing to understand is these are actively managed portfolios. So
what does that mean in this context? They're not your managers are not buying and selling individual stocks, but are they weighting different ETFs differently based on their outlook for the market?
Exactly. So as market conditions change, they will look at the ETFs that comprise the portfolio and they make changes in the allocations or selections of ETF to better reflect those market conditions in the best interests of the customer and the investment strategy.
So how do you think about performance? Because when ETFs were first launched and some of these passive portfolios were introduced, it was very much passive. It was, you know, international, Canadian, U.S. fixed income, set percentages, and you're done. Do you now have an expectation that these actively managed portfolios will exceed the performance of the index over time?
Well, I think the dream always is, and let's face it, at the end of the day, what you really want to do is you want to maximize your return. And there's two ways to maximize your return, and that one is to fully participate in the market and stay, make good investment decisions in terms of the allocation, and quite frankly, make sure you're investing according to your own risk tolerance, right? You know, if you have a conservative outlook or a short time frame, you'd be different than if you have a very long time frame in terms of investing the market. But ultimately, it's about returns. And two things make up returns, which is the performance of the portfolio, which is driven by the market participation you participate in. And the second is the fees, because you want to minimize the fees. So the dream is you want great investment decisions or portfolios with very low fees and ideally actively managed. And if you could get active management at a very low fee, that would be ideal. And that's
why,
what we tried to do.
Why
here.
Would you be on the pro side of the active management debate, given that the statistics are so against that approach in aggregate?
In part because the when I say active management, you got to remember these are portfolios of ETFs. So this is not individual stock picking,
yep.
Right? So the diversification comes two ways. One, through the diversification of the ETFs themselves, and secondly, through which are diversified in their own right. And then secondly, a second level of diversification through, putting together a portfolio of ETFs, right, to get the right participation based on your risk tolerance. And you ask a good question, though, really good question, because the real telling part of that is how much you can lose in fees. And as you know, as we talk about this product, one of the things we talk about is, you know, don't lose 30 or 40 or whatever percent it may be over time to the fee reduction on your returns, because if you're paying, you know, typical, you know, average, you know, balance fund fee of, you know, 2%, that's going to eat up, you know, when you can do the calculation, that could eat up to 30% and sometimes more of your return over time.
So what would drive confidence in an actively managed approach? Who's making those decisions? So if you buy a Canadian equity mutual fund, yes, it has a high MER. It's somewhere about 2.4%, but you can go on the website and find the man or woman who owns that and is the portfolio manager for that particular fund. Who makes the decisions in your shop?
So we have a sub-advisor, which is a company called One Capital Management, who are a sub-advisor who have been doing this for a long time and have a very good record being the sub-advisor for the actively managed. But you also need to understand, when I say actively managed, they don't change that often. But you do want somebody, if there's a major shift in market conditions, like, you know, what have we seen in recent years, like all of a sudden interest rates start to rise, right? And there's been very little movement on interest rates. Well, you know, if you had a totally passive portfolio, probably nothing would be done. But if you had active management, not in a everyday active management, but on a major event active management, then what would happen is they would look at that and say, oh, okay, maybe we need to make a shift here, a minor shift, to make sure we reflect.
When you look on a regular mutual fund, you can see performance since inception. Some of that doesn't really make sense because people combine funds and close them down and all that stuff. But in this case, can you get a historical read given that your sub-advisor has been doing this for a while, or is there no performance?
Yes, you can. If you go on our website, it's very easy. If you go on our website, if you go to the main page, you'll find a tab that there that says Quest 12 Portfolios. If you click into that, you'll go to a page, and as you scroll down that page, you can actually click into each of the portfolios, and you can see the historical return and current performance of every one of the five portfolios, which go from there's conservative, income, balanced growth, and aggressive growth.
Interesting. Well, Stephen, thank you for joining us to talk about the Quest Wealth portfolios. We appreciate it.
You're welcome. There's one other thing I should mention is we also have SRI versions of those portfolios.
Right. Socially responsible. I saw that.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Okay.
All right, Stephen Graham, thank you very much. Stephen Graham, Questrade's Chief Operating Officer. He was here to talk about the launch of the Quest Wealth Portfolios, which replaced the former Questrade Portfolio IQ. Stay with us. Coming up next on Moolala, 5 things you can do to save on taxes. Omar Sheikh from Echelon Wealth Partners will be here. And later, we'll take a look at the ABCs of financial literacy in Canada, specifically a program called Money Matters. If you want more Moolala, download and subscribe to the podcast version of our show on Apple Podcasts. You can also listen on Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Play, and now on Spotify.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Taxes, tax season, the season most people love to hate. Well, we're not quite there yet in the calendar, but we soon will be. And there are some things that you can do to save on your taxes. So this is a perennial topic. Our guest investment advisor, Omar Sheikh, he's with Echelon Wealth Partners, and he has five things you can do now to save on your income taxes. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. I wanted to thank you for having me.
Totally my pleasure. I want to talk about charitable donations because, I mean, it's one of those feel-good things. You cut the check, you get the receipt, you save it until you file your taxes. What should people know about how that works and how to take advantage of that?
That's a great question, Bruce. And this is something I see all the time. And one thing that I would really recommend clients and investors, Canadians, really consider, really focus on taking advantage of that tax credit that you earn for donations above $200.
Right. Is it a total of above $200 or per donation?
It's per donation above $200. And put another way, if you're making multiple donations, smaller donations add up to that amount throughout the year, really the top federal tax credit kicks in for amounts that are above $200.
So you're saying instead of cutting two checks for $100, cut one check for $200.
No, you can definitely add them up. So if you're making multiple donations throughout the year,
it's fine. So just donate more than $200, everybody.
Donate more than $200. But, you know, there's a few strategies that I would add to that as well. And sometimes it's difficult to come up with $200, especially when you've got, you know, 6 weeks left in the year or so and you're trying to find some year-end tax planning to do. A few good strategies. The first I'd recommend is you can actually hold on to those tax receipts for a future year. So if you find that you're the type of person making smaller donations throughout the year and they don't necessarily add up to $200, well, hold on to those receipts for a future year. That way you can get the biggest bang for your buck by making that donation and having the most amount above $200.
My way's easier. Just donate more than $200.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Carry forward on balances on RESP contribution. I am a nut about the RESP.
Right.
How do you make sure you get the most out of that grant?
This is a phenomenal program. And in the investment business, I'm always surprised to see clients not taking full advantage of the RESP program. What you really want to do is consider all of the benefits. And at Echelon Wealth Partners, we take a holistic view, and we don't just consider the government grant associated with the RESP, which I find a lot of people tend to fixate on. What you really want to do is understand the benefits of the tax deferral, the income splitting opportunity, as well as the government grant. So what that means is you would want to consider, first of all, catching up on all of the missed years worth of government grants. The catch is that you can make at most a contribution or receive at most a grant in any 1 year of $1,000.
Right.
So if you've got 5 years worth of grant room that you've accumulated and you haven't taken advantage of, you'll want to sit down with your advisor and work out a strategy such that your contributions that you make every year will maximize the grant received. So for example, if you're making a contribution of $5,000 in 1 year because you've accumulated 5 years worth of room, you'll get the full $1,000 government grant, basically making up for 2 missed years. Well, you'll want to space that out in a way where every year you're earning the maximum.
Because you basically can go back in time 1 year.
Absolutely. So you can go back in time 1 year at a time.
One of the other things to talk about is capital needs and thinking about how you then would utilize your TFSA in that context. Tell me.
Sure. You know, the TFSA program being so new, I find a lot of Canadians are still confused around exactly how the rules work.
Yeah.
And this is something I've seen all the time. clients bringing in statements that say they're getting reassessed through CRA and they're being penalized for early contributions, you want to be mindful of the key rule. Any money that's coming out of that TFSA plan, you can absolutely replace, but you have to wait until at least January 1st of the following year.
Right.
So when sitting down with your advisor, you'll want to figure out, well, what are your cash flow needs over the next, call it 12 to 18 months? Are there any withdrawals that you're considering doing from the TFSA? You know, TFSAs are great for long-term savings. Sometimes you need to dip into them early. Well, if you're planning a withdrawal, consider making that withdrawal before the end of the year. That way, you have the flexibility to be able to recontribute that amount. You don't have to wait until January 1st. Right. It maximizes the flexibility with the program.
Tax loss selling and that whole game is relevant for people who have had a loss, but also you need a gain to offset the loss, right?
Absolutely. So tax loss selling, it's especially important in a year like this year, where you've got the TSX trading down at this point roughly 8% or so on the year. There's a lot of people out there holding investments in their non-registered accounts where they're trading at a loss. So you first want to make sure that if you do have capital gains that you've realized earlier in the year, you're realizing whatever losses, so you're selling investments that potentially no longer fit with your portfolio, that are trading at a loss, you're realizing that loss to first offset any capital gains triggered or realized within this calendar year. The other point that a lot of people forget, unfortunately, you can carry back those losses to the previous three tax years. So if you've had great years in the market in 2015, 2016, and 2017, you can actually realize a loss today, take that loss back over those 3 years after first offsetting the current calendar year's gains and offset gains from previous years, and CRA will basically reassess your return from that year, and you have potentially some hidden tax savings.
You also have a tip on the RIF. So for those people who have turned 71 and they're in that point at which they are about to or have converted from an RSP to a RIF, what should they know?
You know, this is another great opportunity to save some tax. And, you know, probably one of the most unknown available tax credits out there is something called the pension income tax credit. So once you reach at least age 65, you can actually begin to draw a certain amount from your RIF, even if you don't need the funds. And provided you're not otherwise making use of that pension income tax credit, you can draw up to $2,000 a year from your RIF and basically have that money earned or taken out tax-free. So that's very applicable to people aged at least 65 who may not have converted their RSP to a RIF yet, but it's something they can take advantage of. Again, it's about taking out income from your RIF and not paying any tax on it. Make sure you're taking advantage of that pension income tax credit.
A lot of people consider investing and taxes to be very distinct processes. They happen can happen at different times a year. They may use different people. Like either they do their taxes on their own or they have an accountant, but that isn't the same person necessarily as who helps them on investment advice. What's the number one thing that you would say to people who want to do a better job of bringing those two things together?
It's all about the holistic view. And again, at Echelon Wealth Partners, we're a full service advisory firm. Myself as well, you know, to give you some background, I am a certified financial planner and I'm also a CFA charter holder. So that puts a position, someone like me, in a position to really look at it from a financial planning standpoint, which definitely incorporates tax planning, but also incorporating the investment management side of that as well. They are absolutely inseparable. Mm-hmm. You need to consider the tax implications of any investments you're making. And at the same time, when you're making an investment, you want to make sure that you're making the investment from an investment standpoint first and then considering the tax implications. You don't want to be in a position where you're spending $2 to make one.
Right.
And sometimes we see that in the investment world, especially when you're looking at different, you know, tax shelters.
We're Canadian. We pay taxes here.
That's
we get a lot
exactly
of good goodies for our taxes. But let's not pay too much.
That's the key.
Let's not pay too much. Thank you very much, Omar.
Bruce, thank you again for having me.
Omar Sheikh is with Echelon Wealth Partners. He was here talking about five things that you can do now to save on your income taxes when it's time to file. Stay with us. Coming up later, we'll take you through Moolah Law and How I Do It with the Schulich School of Business professor Moshe Milevsky. But next, Ellen Bessner is here to talk about her latest book. It's called Communication Risk, and it identifies some of the challenges that clients have when talking to their advisors. I've also written a couple books. You can order either of them online. The first one is called Moolah Law, Why Smart People Do Dumb Things with Their Money and What You Can Do About It. Stay with us. There's more Moolah Law after the break.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
I do a lot of events with regular people, everyday people, people who don't have the CFA designation, who glaze over when anyone brings up the stock market, who feel intimidated when they have to meet with their financial advisor. So how can you communicate better when it comes to meeting one of the most important people as it relates to your financial well-being? Ellen Besner is a lawyer and an author. Her latest book is called Communication Risk, and it comes with an investor's guide to help you navigate communication with your advisor. Ellen is here to tell us more about it. Hello there.
Hello, how are you?
What are some of the biggest communication challenges that clients deal with their advisors?
So one of the challenges is that they're secretive, they don't trust necessarily, and they're also nervous about asking questions.
Yeah. They're very, very common. People feel very, very anxious about asking questions. Your book is all about trying to improve that. For successful client-advisor relationships, you have three steps. The first one is honesty and transparency. What does that mean?
So they should feel that comfortable enough with their advisor so that they tell them what their goals are if they know them. And if they don't know what their goals are and they need help trying to figure those out, they should be transparent with their advisor even about that.
To say, I don't know. Ask me some smart and insightful questions and I will answer those questions.
Exactly.
Openness, number two. What's that mean?
So again, don't hold back. If you have questions, if there's something that enters your mind and you're self-conscious about it, just get it out there.
Regular contact is number three. What does regular mean in your view?
Regular contact is if you get your statement, whenever it is that you open it up, and it should be upon receiving it, and if you don't understand it, you pick up the phone, you speak to your advisor, and you tell him or her, I don't understand my statement. Can we have a conversation about it?
Where is the responsibility for each party in fostering strong communication? So those three things, we're talking about it from the perspective of the client. Yes, they can show up endeavoring to do those three things. But where's the responsibility for the advisor in creating an environment in which the client feels like they can be honest, transparent, and open?
So the advisor steers the relationship, but you can only bring forward your professional advice to a client, but if the client doesn't open up with you, it's really hard to figure out what their goals are and what they want to achieve. So while the advisor steers the relationship, if the client doesn't come forward with their information, with their concerns, with their questions, then it's going to be a failed relationship.
I've done a lot of work training advisors on how to engage with clients. And part of that was helping them get used to having really, really tough conversations. The what are your goals? What's retirement like? They're easy, easy to have. Look at your investment portfolio. Very, very easy. Divorce, fertility issues, aging parents. These are really, really tough. From the client's expectations, where does the advisor end and the therapist begin?
So I don't think it's really a therapy session. I think, though, the questions that you said are easy questions. It's not really about asking the questions that makes it difficult. It's listening to the answer and trying to dig under what the client really feels, what the client really means by their answer. Because to ask superficial questions and to get superficial answers will never get the client where they need to be.
There is an enormous spectrum and skill level on the advisor's part. Would you agree?
Definitely.
Huge. So as you're interviewing advisors, as the client, how do you gauge their communication skills and judge whether or not he or she is able to work at that level?
So in my book, I have a little chart. And in the chart, it says, these are the kinds of questions you have to ask. These are the kinds of things you want to look for in your advisor. First of all, you want to look for somebody who's available to you, who listens well, when you ask a question is responsive to your questions. But there's a whole list. It goes on for, I think, a couple of pages in a chart. Very, very easy to digest. Simply explaining what the client should be looking for in their present advisor and what to do if your present advisor is not doing the things that I suggest are important.
Are they trainable? Are advisors trainable? Can the client say, hey, I read this great book from Ellen Besner, and here's how you need to serve me better?
I don't think it's the client's job to do that, but sure, I think that they are trainable. I believe everybody is trainable if they want to be. I think the question really for clients to ask themselves is, you can't change other people, but how can you change yourself to improve this relationship? Have you been open enough? Have you sat down with your advisor and said, look, I read this chart, and let me take you through it. These are my concerns. It's really to change yourself that's the challenge.
What can a client realistically expect if they aren't someone with $2 million in assets under management and getting the platinum service that would go alongside that? If you've got 100 grand, you are not considered high net worth, you simply cannot expect to get 48 hours in a year.
I don't think the question necessarily is how much they have today. It's how much will they have that the advisor's more interested in. Is how can they help them grow towards a healthy retirement?
I agree, but if you've only got 100 grand, mm-hmm. you're getting a you should expect a lesser service experience than if you've got 2 million bucks, in only that you're worth so much less revenue to them.
I don't believe that that's the case. I'm a lawyer. On my smaller files, I don't give less attention
but
to
you
my
charge
clients.
But you charge an hourly rate that's similar.
I do, but I still give 100% to my clients on every single phone call I'm on with them. So advisors should be giving 100% of themselves when they're on the phone with their clients, and they should service them according to their needs. If they only have one mutual fund and, you know, or if they only have a couple of small investments, then how much does the client need? But in that first meeting and in their annual meetings, they should be all there with their clients. They should be present. They should be listening.
But we shouldn't expect that they're going to have the same time to contribute.
I don't know why not, because the reality is that you've got to get under whatever it is that the client needs and what is it that their financial needs are and how do you figure that out without time?
I would love if that were the case, but if someone's only got, and I say only with air quotes, only got 100 grand, they're probably going to be in a bank, on a bank branch or and with a financial advisor who may not even have a CFP.
And it may not be necessary for them to have a CFP. And it may be that a bank branch person can help them a lot.
Yeah, totally. So, and this is not a criticism of people who work in any format. There are amazing advisors in every part of this country. I want to segue on to seniors and women. Those are two subgroups in which you focus on in your book. You've got chapters dedicated to them. What are some of the communication nuances that relate to those two demographics?
So with regard to seniors, it's very challenging because as we're used to in the Know Your Client forum, the advisor has to gauge whether or not the client understands what they're saying. And they need to really gauge what their financial acumen or understanding is. And as we get older, unfortunately, that decreases with time yeah. for most people, doesn't increase. So the challenge for advisors and clients is to adjust to that. Does the client have a power of attorney? Do they have somebody who they trust who they can bring to meetings? My mother brings me sometimes. Do they have an advisor who will have the patience for them and for the changes that occur? For women,
yeah.
For women, they need to really understand the different values of each person. You can't put all women in one category, just like you can't put all men in one category. So you want to be careful and read the chapter. Mm. You'll see what it is. And, you know, funny because clients are reading these chapters as well so that they get a better insight into themselves.
Mm. One last question before we go. What are the conflicts of interest or potential conflicts of interest that advisors have to deal with in order to communicate effectively? And one example is providing tough love to a client on their spending habits when you don't want to lose the client because the client might be like, yeah, take care, bye-bye, don't want to be judged on my spending.
That is a big problem. The other big problem is some clients have been incredibly generous with other people, like their children, and then they get to a stage when they get older and they don't have enough money for their retirement and they turn to their advisor and say, I want high risk investments
right.
so that I have high return. The advisor has to say no. Mm. Really difficult conversation.
Well, thank you very much for your insight and your experience on this. Lots of work for both clients and advisors to do.
Thank you, Bruce.
Ellen Bessner is a lawyer and the author of Communication Risk. Stay with us. Coming up next, we're going to talk about financial literacy in Canada and a program from ABC Life Literacy called Money Matters. We'll also talk to Moshe Malevsky about the Moolala, How I Do It. I'm also the money columnist for CityLine, which is a daily lifestyle show on air across North America. You can check out some of the segments that I have done at cityline.tv, then search for me. Or even better, watch the segments from Marilyn Smith and Claire Tansey. They're a couple of the chefs on CityLine. They're fantastic. I'm making Claire Tansey's pot roast tonight. Stick around. We'll be right back after the break. Thank you.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
For many Canadians, dealing with finances is so overwhelming. That can be due to a lot of different factors, but certainly one of them is not having the basic knowledge to manage their finances. Money Matters is a national program that helps Canadians improve on their financial literacy skills. Melanie Karras is the program coordinator at Youth the Future, a partner with Money Matters. And Jillian Stewart is also here to share her personal experience as a participant in the program. They join us now from Dartmouth, Nova Scotia. Hello to you both.
Hello.
Melanie, what is the Money Matters program? What's its intention and what are some things that you cover?
So the Money Matters program, we have TD volunteers that come in and actually run the program. And they're touching on things like spending plans, banking basics, borrowing money, RRSPs. So really about helping people manage their money and giving like good financial understanding.
What are some common challenges that people have, do you think, when it comes to financial literacy?
So our program is a paid program. So what happens is that generally for a lot of clients coming in, they don't have the budgeting knowledge of when they first get their first paycheck. We did have it before Money Matters, where we had clients going out and buying like a TV with their very first paycheck, and then the next week they had nothing left over for like lunch. So I think it's also about just helping people better understand how to manage their money. And that's really important for a program like this, and helping people to feel really empowered when they are working and using that knowledge going forward.
Jillian, how did you hear about the program?
It's actually a workshop that we do as part of Youth the Future.
So it was kind of included in what you were signed up for?
Yeah.
And what was appealing to you about it? Or were you horrified by the prospect and someone forced you to do it?
No, actually, I was interested. So I didn't have any real knowledge of financial information literacy before this because they don't teach that in high school.
Nope, they don't. So you showed up in the workshop room, and what do you remember about some of the things that you learned?
Well, I learned that maybe I should cut down on my coffee spending.
Right. Anything else?
I learned about credit cards and how they actually work.
Yeah. It's kind of shocking, hey, when you realize what happens if you don't pay it off.
Yeah. I was always told that they were not good.
Yeah. How did it feel having this conversation with other people? Because a lot of times people have a lot of concern about talking about money. It's like in our culture, we're supposed to know more. We're supposed to do better. It would be different than just doing, you know, the War of 1812 in history class.
Yeah, it was interesting. We all had kind of different views, different experiences prior to this workshop.
Now, Melanie, for you, this is also with the Canadian Council of Rehabilitation and Work. Tell us about CCRW and how that fits into the conversation around financial literacy.
Sure. So with CCRW, so our program, Youth the Future, is really about helping people to with all of the skills necessary to obtain and retain employment. So part of the program is more in-class based and helping people get ready with all of the skills that they need, and then with a work placement. So it really connects in a tremendous way because of the fact that our clients are coming in and maybe some of them have never had a job before, or they've been out of work for a while. So having that financial literacy there is really a key part to helping to better understand and manage their money. And so it's really a great fit with CCRW and what they're doing. So when we came across the opportunity to pair with ABC Life Literacy, their Money Matters program, it was just a no-brainer.
What are some of the benefits that you hear from people who have participated in the program? What would they say?
Yeah, so we actually just ran the program last week again for our new cohort, and I had some quotes that I wrote down from some of the clients, and some of the things that they'd said was, now that I know better, I can do better. And another one that we had was, it makes me feel so empowered to know this. And literally right after the Money Matters workshops, the first day was done, because we do it over 2 days, someone had went home, had called Their phone companies had called their credit cards, had got lower interest rates. And I think in a span of one day, we had someone who saved $150.
Wow.
So it's really tangible, and it's just great depending on, I mean, we're all at different places. So some people are coming with perhaps a lot of debt and some people, you know, have none. So depending, it doesn't really matter where people are at. It meets them where they are and helps them with that knowledge of how to keep going from there.
One of the elements of the context for Canadians being out there in the world is there's this enormous financial services industry that both helps and in some ways hinders people getting a handle on their money because they make those credit cards so available. Where does an understanding of this environment fit in, Melanie? Is it important for people to know how the industry works so that they can take advantage of the services that are a fit and try and avoid those that may be not a fit or, you know, in some cases even predatory, like, you know, payday loans for people sometimes are really not the solution for them to get through?
Yeah, so we definitely talk about within the program all different kinds of ways that you can borrow money and which are the more beneficial ways and ones to go with and which are the ones to look out for, like the payday loans and places with a really high interest rate. Unfortunately, we did have some of our clients who kind of unknowingly stepped into that. And it wasn't until after and really for some of them through the course of the Money Matters program that they were able to understand a bit more of the information that they didn't know up front. So helping people to better understand how that works and how they can borrow or save money effectively and having a better understanding of that.
Jillian, what do you think is next for you? So you've participated in this program. You've certainly learned a lot. What are some things that you'd like to know more about as life unfolds for you?
Definitely want to learn more about credit cards as they can be pretty useful, as I found out this spring.
Why did you try and buy something? And they said the only way you can buy this is using a credit card.
No, actually, my mom and I got stranded at Victoria Airport.
Oh, geez. And so this was a job for the plastic to help rescue you.
Yeah, because we couldn't get a hotel room without a credit card. We couldn't get a rental vehicle without a credit card.
Right. Well, that's an amazing example of, the combination of what one can learn in a classroom and then the rubber hits the road when you're out there in the real world, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Jillian, thank you very much for joining us today. We appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
And Melanie as well. So Melanie Caress, Program Coordinator at Youth the Future, a partner with the Money Matters program, and Jillian Stewart was a student in the program. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
There is a lot of theoretical talk about money. One of the things that's important to me, though, is to make personal finance practical and real. So we have this segment that we call How I Do It, and it's a series of basic questions about how our guests manage their own money. Our guest today is Moshe Milevsky. He is a professor, finance professor at York University's School of Business. And Moshe, I want you to answer just the first thing that comes to your mind, okay?
All right.
You buy coffee at a local coffee shop. You could buy tea. I don't know what you buy. But do you pay with cash, debit, or credit? And why?
I use neither of those three. I use an app. What would you consider that?
Oh, when you use the app, does it debit out of your bank account or go to your credit card?
It would actually, it's an account where you add money to it once every couple of months and it reduces the balance. So
right.
I don't know, Bruce, where are we going to categorize?
I need it? Another category, a non-cash equivalent. Jeez.
Yeah.
So here's my follow-up. What do you use cash for?
You know, I find myself using it less and less. I've become like my teenage kids. They don't even know what it is anymore. They just use debit and credit and personal loans from one another. I find myself using less and less cash, and I hate to say this, but in the future, we may not have it all together.
Yeah. What about your financial life? Have you automated?
You know, the automation of all bill payments is something that took me a while to get into. I used to like to see the bill, think about it, reflect on it. Why was that the bill? And then pay it sort of online. And then I realized this was eating up a lot of time. It's now done automatically.
And I kind of lose track of what's being paid for what and how much is being spent because it's all being done automatically. I would say 15 different invoices and bills that I used to pay manually are now being done automatically online.
What about savings? Do you automate? I mean, I know you're a professor, so you have this amazing pension that you're going to get in, you know, like in about probably a year and a half. Good for you. I'm only partly kidding. Do you automate savings for other things like vacation or...
I do. I like to automate savings in the sense that I'd like to automate budgets. So, you know, there's a budget that you have for long-term retirement savings. There's a budget that you have for gifts that you want to buy. So I like the less decisions I have to make, the better is the way I think about it. Especially after a long day, you're busy, you've spent a lot of energy making decisions. I like to make it so that I don't have to make decisions unless I absolutely have to. And I think that that's a good plan for retirement as well. Automate the retirement planning process.
Who manages your investments? Are you a DIY guy, a robo-advisor guy, a full-service financial advisor guy? What's your approach?
You know, I would say all of the above. I really like the benefit of bouncing ideas off financial advisors. And I like the idea of paying them for time, like I do a lawyer or an accountant or any consultant, where I'll say, look, I'm thinking of doing this strategy. What do you think? And they'll say, oh, Moshe, you're off your rocker about it.
Right.
And even though they're not necessarily managing the money, they're certainly not getting a fee for it. But I value that tremendously because otherwise it's an echo chamber. You're just thinking about it and doing it and talking to yourself. Implementation, execution, it's do it yourself. You go online, brokerage account, you make the trade, or you make the investment, or you buy the insurance policy. But after a lot of consultation, I would say.
You're a professor. Is it safe to say that you have a defined benefit pension?
Well, it's a complicated plan. That's why I was chuckling when you said earlier I can retire in 2 years, more like 25. But it's a defined benefit plan that's a floor, and there's a defined contribution element to it. So
right.
I, in all probability, will be retiring in a DC plan, not a DB plan.
Right. And so does that mean, given that you have that floor, does that mean all of your other savings are in cryptocurrency and cannabis?
Oh, yeah. Ether and let's see, what did I buy yesterday?
Yeah, all of that stuff. Do you think of the DB part as fixed income?
Oh, yes. In fact, I think of my job as fixed income. When you think of a unionized teacher or police officer, fireman, for that matter.
Right.
The job is an income that should be treated as fixed income. So I view that as part of my fixed income allocation, which is why I'm more aggressive with stocks and equity, because I view my human capital as being a bond. I like to joke with my wife, honey, I'm a bond.
Right. She looks at you and says, you are not Danielle Craig, honey. I'm sorry.
Well, she also asks me what happens if a car runs over her bond, then what she does.
Right, right.
That's where life insurance comes in, obviously. But the idea is, yes, I agree with you, Bruce, it's fixed income.
Who prepares your taxes, you or an accountant?
Oh, dear, don't ask. I wish I could do it myself, but it is extremely complicated. I am in the situation where I'm also a U.S. citizen because I was originally from there, so I've got to file in both countries. And I've got a team of people, and I wish I could fire them all.
Now, you have kids. You can't fire your kids. Do they get an allowance in your home?
They do. They do. And from a very young age, I taught them to budget, even when they didn't quite understand what that meant. And I think hopefully in the long run, that will help them understand that life is about living within the budget constraint. And the first, you know, the earlier they get used to it, the better.
What are you nuts about and what are you casual about when it comes to your money? Like, are you nuts on turning off the lights when you leave the room and casual about, I don't know, insurance quotes?
You know, what bothers me are the things that we tend to ignore that accumulate month after month after month. So things that are, well, it's just $7. You know, I'll give you this Spotify bill. You know, we've got a bunch of family members and everybody's got their Spotify and they're all paying for it. And I'm thinking, why don't we have a family plan? So we're talking about saving 10 or 15 bucks. My kids think I'm nuts emphasizing this, but it's just these
right.
small automatic things that sort of get on my nerves. I think that overall you have to be realistic in terms of expenses. You really have to understand that the distraction that comes from trying to minimize expenses. You may spend a lot of time trying to reduce expenditures when, in fact, the time was better spent doing something else. Mm. So I don't know if I answered your question, but there are certainly things that bother me.
You did. And if you have a family Spotify bill, it means your kids can program your playlist and make you all the more cooler when it comes to music.
Did not know that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think they can do that. Moshe, thank you for your time today. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Moshe Milevsky is a finance professor at York University's Schulich School of Business. That is our time for today. If you've got a comment, a suggestion for my Spotify playlist, a question or a story idea, send us a note to ask@moolala.ca. You can also track me on Facebook, Bruce Celery Moolala, or @Bruce Celery on Twitter. Thanks very much for joining us. Have a great day.